I am speaking to you from the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently, this country is at war with Germany.
Following the outbreak of World War II, sea forts were built in the Thames estuary for the protection of the coastal areas in London from enemy aircraft and shipping attacks. They were principally there to give an early warning, using their then-new radar equipment, to break up aircraft formations and also to prevent the mine-laying of the important sea route to London. Two types of fort were built, both two designed by Mr. G.A. Maunsell. Four of them were for the Navy, out in the open sea, while the Army had three further inshore. All of these forts were constructed at Gravesend in Kent by Holloway Brothers at a cost of around £71,000 each. The Navy forts consisted of a pontoon base supporting two hollow concrete legs about 8 metres diameter, which contained seven decks, housing quarters for 100 men, food supplies, fuel and ammunition storage. These legs were topped by a steel platform for the Bofors and Lewis guns, and also upon this was built the control tower and the radar equipment. Each fort, fully manned and ready for action, was commissioned at the building yard and then towed out by three tugs. The first Navy fort was sighted off Harwich in February 1942. The method of grounding was to open the valves on the hollow pontoon base, thus letting in seawater, causing the fort to slowly sink into position. The Navy forts were situated at Knock John, Tongue Sand, the Sunk Sands, and at the Roughs. The Army forts at Shivering Sand, Red Sand, and the Great Nore were completely different in style to the Navy forts, being similar in layout to a shore-based anti-aircraft site. There were seven towers in each complex. The control tower was in the centre, and surrounding this were five gun towers, with a searchlight tower to the rear. Each tower comprised four concrete legs supporting a steel structure. They were all self-contained with fuel and food supplies, as well as living and sleeping accommodation. They were linked by steel catwalks, which also carried fuel and power lines from tower to tower. Specially made barges carried the towers two at a time out to their grounding sites, where they were lowered by winches onto the seabed. All of the forts were successfully positioned, and between them shot down 22 enemy aircraft and about 25 flying bombs. The Tongue Sand Tower off Margate also captured an enemy submarine that was attempting to torpedo the fort. After the war, the forts were abandoned. The Army fort at the Great Nore was demolished in 1958 as it was in the shipping lanes. The Shivering Sands fort lost a tower when a ship ran into it. Four people were killed then, the only casualties on the forts up to that time, and the ship finished up at Southend with one of the catwalks still across its decks. The forts were to remain disused for nearly 20 years, until, as we've heard, Screaming Lord Sutch sailed past in May 1964. So far, we've heard the story of radio stations operating from the Army forts. Two of the Navy forts were also taken over. One of these, the Sunk Head, was used for radio tower. Sunday, May the 16th, 1965, and following the success of the other offshore stations on the air, Clacton businessman Reg Torr, together with engineer George Short, start the first test transmissions from Radio Pamela. Pamela was to transmit only on Sundays from an 18-foot motorboat, principally playing pop music and carrying adverts for Reg Torr's business, TD Television. After a few weeks, the idea was dropped. George Short went to see Eric Sullivan.
And then George Short came along to me some weeks afterwards, quite appalled with the idea that they were going to drop everything and nothing was going to come of it at all. So we decided, or I decided, that with his knowledge of technology and mine of business, that we could get something off the ground.
Big tea, big tea, big.
we decided that we would do test transmissions and the places that we would go. So we decided, number one, that it'd be the Ruff's Tower. And we went out there, we hired a boat, we took us out, and I went there with Johnny Walters and a friend of his. And we tried to board the tower, but the weather wasn't in our favour, and we couldn't. So we decided that the next weekend we would come out with equipment, boarding equipment, and equipment to keep us alive, and board the thing. Unfortunately, or fortunately, whichever way you want to look at it, this information was then transferred to Percy Scadden, who in turn informed Radio Caroline, who took over the fault. So then we were left with only one other alternative. That was the sunk head.
About a week after this, Eric Sullivan and crew boarded the sunk head towers and George Short set up the transmitter for the first tests on 216 metres.
Tower radio testing. Here is tower radio testing on 216 metres in the medium wave band. Tower radio testing.
Well, we looked for anybody that was really adventurous. Anybody really, we had the right person with the engineering qualifications that could vet any further engineers that we needed. Johnny Walters, I looked to him really because he was a man of many voices and could be used quite comfortably as a DJ.
Eventually Eric Sullivan contacted me again. I said, you know, are you still interested, John? So I said, yes. So he said, when would you be free to go out? So I said, more or less any time. I forget the exact time, but anyway, one day he approached me and said, can you make it at the weekend, I believe it was. I said, right. So he said we would be leaving from Burnham. Well, the first time we went, we didn't get on. It was John Bolter and Terry Lambeth. They were on board looking like a couple of hermits. And I looked up at this fort from the girl, Betty, and says, oh, my God, no, I can't get up there. Now, it's a very frightening experience, really, because you see this giant monster, you know, protruding from the North Sea. And you think to yourself, you've got to get on this. Anyway, they put this straight ladder hooked over the top of the fort on the gantry, down, which went below the sea level, like, you know, mm-hmm. And it was about 9 inches wide, and you had to sort of get on the bow of the boat. When someone said jump, you jumped. If you hesitated, you was in the drink.
There are vacancies on this station for vision engineers, transmission radio engineers, and DJs. If you have the suitable qualifications for any of these posts, would you please contact Mr. Eric D. Sullivan, Vision Projects, Trinity Street, Colchester. Telephone Colchester 6741.
I'd listened to the station quite a while, and one day they were asking for DJs and other staff. I told my family and friends I'm thinking of applying. I think they all thought Bill Rawlings has gone completely nutty. Anyway, took the tape up, made a demo tape, took it up to Colchester. Went into the office in Colchester and they played it back, and Eric Sullivan said, well, it's not too bad, you can go out there. A week after this, I'm standing on the deck of a tug called the Agamar from Felixstowe, and we're pulling alongside the sunk head towers, and, you know, I can sort of remember now thinking to myself, God, you know, just, you know, what am I doing in a situation like this? I shouldn't be here, you know, this is ridiculous. So over comes a ladder, and you've just got to run up this ladder. Bit different when I got to the top to what I had expected. I expected something a bit more plush, and there's these rather untidy people who haven't had a shave for a few days standing around there. And a conducted tour of the fort was in hand, so tagged along with all the new guys that went out there on that trip, and we saw the generator, you know, a little single cylinder petrol driven thing charging these batteries like there was no tomorrow. The transmitter was an old wireless set 52, held together by bits of hardboard, but it was getting the signal out, and after all, that was part of the business that we were doing.
Tower Radio, the local radio station. These are test engineering tests only. Please send reception reports to Vision Projects, Trinity Street, Colchester. This is Tower Radio testing. Tower Radio testing. Tower Radio testing at your first local radio station. Please send all test report signals to Vision Projects, Trinity Street, Colchester. Tower Radio, 9¾ miles from Walton-on-Naze.
Dave Simpson came to me, not as an employee. He came as wanting a cut into the business and become a director. And I was out of the office at the time. And I'd been out some considerable time. I think I was one of my journeys to London, or I'd been to the town, was on my way back. I can't really remember which. But I know I arrived in my office to find a rather Western-type gentleman sitting there with a beard and a sombrero, wanted to invest money and become something to do with Radio Tower. And I thought, well, there's a mad American sitting in front of me with a carrier bag with pound notes in it, wants to invest in me. Who am I to say no? And from that day on, I think we headed off, Dave and I. There was something there that said that we could get on. And he wanted the practical side of the business, as did I. I wasn't really totally enjoying the financial side or the running of the advertising. I was more interested in the practical side, I suppose. And this is where we really sort of met each other halfway. He wanted in, I needed the money, he needed to be in that business for what reason only he will ever know.
Well, I saw it on Anglia television, and I saw the romantic side of becoming a disc jockey, and because it was the in thing, everybody was interested in this sort of a local radio operation thing, you see, so I thought, well, I'll be part of it.
Radio Tower is a real cool show. Radio Tower, all systems go. Music on your own or wherever people mix. Get with it now on 236. Radio Tower, Radio Tower, Radio Tower, Radio Tower, Big T.
Once I got on the fort, the first person I met was John Waters, and John introduced me to George Short. And there was two other guys there, John Bolter and Terry Lambert, who were the transmission sort of maintenance men. They looked after all the generators and stuff like that. George had the idea that I was going to be the transmission engineer and where he got this idea from, but I sort of got him showing me how to turn this on and turn that on. And just after he had, he said, well, go into the studio, you can put a couple of records on. And the next thing I know is John Waters, Dave Simpson and myself were left on the fort, and George Short had gone. I had a sort of basic knowledge of transmitters, very basic as well, and was left to get just sorted out from there. We managed to get out test transmissions, but gradually the quality went down and down, and I couldn't really work it out as to get the signal back any better.
Well, I expected to see something up to date, like just roughly an example, like a big freezer, refrigerator set up there, all a match system with a big aerial, and, you know, being able to blast anywhere just about in this part of the world. But, of course, what a letdown when we got there, huh? A little Jap engine run away there, when it would run, when it wasn't out of fuel or out of spark or something.
Well, I didn't know. I mean, someone could have showed me a matchbox and said, this will transmit 500 miles. I probably would have believed them. But at first I thought, yeah, everything's all right. Of course, when we didn't get reception reports or dodgy signals, you know, were coming through, then I started to think different.
It was now December 1965, and the original transmitter engineer, George Short, had left the station by now. He had for some time been suffering with stomach trouble and on one occasion had to call for assistance from the Walton lifeboat.
Hi, Thames, 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 Walton lifeboat, over.
This is Thames, Coast Guard, over.
Hello, Thames. We now have this casualty in sight. We can hear them calling for help. We're now approaching, over.
This is Thames, roger.
I was informed immediately, as I always was, and I went to Walton, taking with me one of the pressmen, Paddy Mullins at the time. And we went to Walton Pier to await the arrival of the lifeboat, who brought George off. Supposedly run out of tablets for a prostate gland. He never went back onto the tower again and eventually died with cancer.
Following the loss of George Short, a new transmitter engineer was found, Derek Masson. This only added to the problem.
I don't think the test transmissions worried us. In the original state, the test transmissions were fantastic. It was only after the employment of really Derek Masson that the test transmissions started to become worrying, really. The problems with Derek Masson, I think he was afraid to become illegal. He was afraid that because he was involved in any way, shape or form with Radio Tower, it would outlaw him from anywhere else in the country whatsoever. He just had this funny thing about being an alien, I think, and he just couldn't do his job.
But now other backers were found. The late Tommy Shields from Radio Scotland had shown an interest in the company, but eventually it was Peter Jeeves that joined Eric Sullivan.
Eventually Peter Jeeves came along with the idea of becoming a director and going into offshore broadcasting. We met in Regent Street, and after a very short and sharp talk, he was in. We eventually clinched a deal in Hilton, and he became a co-director after George Short pulled out through illness. He became a co-director with myself. We each held 51% of the shares of Vision Projects, Sullivan's Holdings, Jeeves Holdings, and one other company, Radio Haywards Heath. Which are all solvent companies, all registered in Ireland, all registered in Dublin. And that's how the basis of the crowd got together.
This is Radio Tower and 236 Meters, your first local station. Here is the programme lineup for tomorrow. 7 till 9, Bill Rollins. 9 till 11, Chris Goslin. 11 to 2, I Will Be Back. And 2 till 4, Dave Simpson with a good old country and western. 4 to 6, Graham London. 6 to 7, back again, John. And 7 to 8, Bill Rollins.
Throughout this time, staff on the tower continued their test transmissions. Inland, ideas for programs were being sorted out. Ideas for women's programs, local sport and talent shows were also on the cards. Unlike many of the other pirate stations, Tower was set up as a local station.
We wanted something a bit more personal to the area. Hence, we decided on television, which just didn't get off the ground. The early test transmissions could have been okay, but we were ordered. I went to a meeting in London at the head office in Mayfair, and we were, in no uncertain terms, ordered by Anthony Wedgwood Benn, that should we do any transmissions of television, then we would be classed as aliens, foreigners, whatever, and we would be treated as such. In other words, we would hostiles in television. So we gave up the idea of television there and then, and I did put a notice in the newspapers at that time saying that we would now concentrate on local radio. And we wanted to be different. We didn't want to be a normal pop station. We just wanted to be something different in our own area with prices that everybody could afford, the average shopkeeper could afford.
Now Tower was devoted to local radio. Advertising was coming in, both local and national companies.
Carried Advertising, which was sold by Bob Record and Peter Jeeves, who were really top-class salesmen. Peter Jeeves, in as much as was with Condé Nast before he came to us, and also with Southern Television selling time. He did get the News of the World Advertising, and also a Boulevard Watch and the Seventh-day Adventists, which paid a lot of money for advertising then. And we had really in the bag at that time somewhere in the region of about £180,000 worth of advertising revenue to use as soon as we were on the air.
Things seemed to be going well. Earlier troubles with tendering had finished. Tower now had its own tender, the Margie, a converted Icelandic trawler skippered by Casey Romus, ex-captain of the Weissmuller Company's offshore one tender. One day, the Margie arrived at the fort with plenty of beer, whiskey and cigarettes. John Waters remembers this incident rather fondly.
I thought, my goodness, what a wonderful time we're going to have. And this is what it was, really, because we was not, you know, not getting a signal and or transmitting very well, apart from all these test transmissions. So I sat at the console with whiskey, beer, cigarettes surrounding me and had a whale of a time.
But the wonderful time described by John Waters was short-lived. The Margie was impounded by customs at Ipswich. The station was set to go on air officially on Thursday, the 21st of April, 1966. But on the 11th of April, a very different transmission filtered through the noise.
He was expecting a supply boat. We was running short. We couldn't transmit. We couldn't do anything. And we was just stuck on the fort, you know, with absolutely nothing to do. The supply boat had been promised, and we had no idea what was wrong, you know, nothing at all. And because this is where the rot must have set in and everything had sort of gone kaput.
Well, I think it all comes back down to poor management. Even though I was supposed to have been one of the directors, I was sea-bound, if you like, or fort-bound. I couldn't get in and do some of the things I wanted to, and we were given to understand that this was being handled in London through Mr. Peter Jeeves and through the head man, Mr. Eric Sullivan, who was supposed to have this all under control. And whether it was facts like weather that eventually beat us, or whether it was the threats of the government to close us down, whether it was the improvised way we had to operate with the equipment we had, we didn't really know to where our broadcasts were going to, whether they were getting across. It was we was a long time getting our reception reports back. I think we had an uphill grind all the way.
I was the youngest member of the crew and possibly didn't follow the politics of what was happening between the management, the staff, and, you know, how things were going quite as closely as the others. But I in my opinion, I think we could have made it and should have made it. The loss to the station, as far as I was concerned, was George Short. He had earlier proved that the transmissions could go out well, even using old equipment. And we had, at the beginning, good transmissions. But after Derek was employed, the signals died away and no improvement was made to them. And I think the date was coming up to be set for the 21st of April to go on the air, and we just couldn't make the date and lost revenue and eventually lost backers into the station, and that caused its collapse.
I think early mistakes were probably half the battle, in as much as spending too much time on television before turning to radio. Had we have gone into radio right from the beginning and used radio only, I think we would have probably been one of the forerunners. And we were in dire straits for money at this time, and to enable us to get people off the tower that were already out there, no money was changed hands, just our outside broadcast van was given to one of the fishermen, Billy Bennett, to go out and fetch the remainder of the men off the tower.
The official on-air date of April the 21st passed, and it wasn't until Thursday the 28th of April 1966 that the fishing boat owned by Billy Bennett arrived at the tower. Little time was left to pack belongings, but the return journey and the arrival at Harwich had a few more surprises in store. Remember the whiskey and the cigarettes?
Well, I thought might as well have a final fling coming back to Harwich. I had a couple of bottles of whiskey. I think I drank one on the way back and put cigarettes in my bag. On arriving at Harwich, customs were all waiting and crowds of people. They asked us to empty the bags. I refused, so they emptied my bag. Took out the... the whiskey had gone then. Yes, I was just left with cigarettes. Anyway, there was English-made cigarettes, which was all right, you know. Plus these foreign-made cigarettes. They said, well, you're not allowed to have these. You've been a naughty boy. Where did you get them? I said, well, I bought them at a shop out in the North Sea somewhere. So then they turned around and said, would you accompany us to the office, which I did. Consequently, I was fined £12 on the spot for smuggling. And I said, well, what becomes of the cigarettes? They said, well, these go to the Queen. I said, well, surely the Queen doesn't smoke this bloody rubbish.
Big tea, big tea, big tea, big tea. Stay tuned to Radio Tower.
Well, if I did it again, I'd do it my way. There's a song, I think, that goes like that. But I don't regret it, but I think it was a great education. And I'm not sorry. I mean, I've met some nice people. I think it was a very romantic thing, a very, I mean, romantic in the sense that it was enlightening. It was, what you would say, like climbing the Everest, if you like. It was a challenge. I think put it back down to the word educational, and I think I got educated.
I just think it was a great challenge and something I'll never regret. I'll always remember it as being part of my life that was a major experience.
The fort was to be back in the news. In November 1966, two squatters were rescued from the fort by Walton Lifeboat. The two men, Dexter Stoneham of London and C.T. Payne of Bexley in Kent, refused to say why they were on the fort, apart from stating that there was no connection with radio. However, David Hart, a film director, had told Coast Guards during September that he was placing two squatters on board. Almost another year passed, but on Friday the 18th of August 1967, 20 Royal Engineers boarded the fort. After several small explosions and 3 days' work, the final charge, £2,200 of explosive, was set. And at 4:18, the biggest peacetime explosion marked the end of the Sunkhead Fort. Today, all that remains are the stumps of the legs, which are still used as a navigational aid to shipping entering the Thames estuary.
The Knockjohn Naval Fort was taken over for radio use by former fishing fleet owner Roy Bates.
There was no other way of getting independent radio into the UK, except as we did in those days have pirate radio, which was of course the forerunner to the present day independent radio's commercial stations they have now. It was the only way you could do it. We were the only, I think, the only station which was owned by a family or an individual. We were also the only station which was totally English money. All the others had foreign money. And all the others were trying to run national too. We didn't do any of these things.
Time 1 o'clock and we pause for a station identification.
You're in tune with Radio Essex Broadcasting on 222 metres, medium wave.
They started transmitting on October the 27th, 1965, and I joined them late January. I went and saw Roy Bates one afternoon. And on Radio Essex, which I didn't know at the time, but everybody had to have more than one job. He wasn't content to have you as a disc jockey. You had to be a diesel mechanic or something rather similar. Well, I wasn't a diesel mechanic, but I was employed in the Air Force as a cook, you see. And once I mentioned the words that I could cook, I found myself on the payroll.
Michael Caine recalled how he came to join the station.
I'd never even seen the fort before. I'd seen a few kind of sketches of it in Roy Bates' house, and I'd never really, never thought how large it was. And I remember being on the fishing boat, cold, very cold, and gazing out the window from the bridge of this fishing boat and seeing this small dot on the horizon getting larger and larger. Then to be confronted with this huge fort, which quite stunned me. I'd never ever seen any of your forts in the Thames estuary before, and thought was when we got there we had to jump over about a yard's worth of sea to get onto the actual platform itself. The landing stage had been wrecked at some stage and was leaning at an angle of about 45 degrees. So you had a ladder which was leaning heavily to the right. You had to climb up quick enough before the boat hit the back of your feet. And then having got on the landing stage, a rope was lowered that you tied around your waist. You were physically hauled on board.
It was full of dead birds and feathers and droppings, and it was a bit knocked about too. There were a couple of yachtsmen that had been stranded there the year before, tore all the doors off to make a raft because they were dying of thirst. There were 6,000 gallons in the tank above their heads, but they didn't look. If they turned the taps on, they'd have found running water, but they didn't do it.
Living conditions at the beginning were very spartan, and it was some time before things became anywhere near normal. Joan Bates recalls an early visit to the fort.
We went out to stay at Christmas time, just one Christmas I had out there, and cooked the turkey and had a lovely Christmas with all the boys, you know. Really most enjoyable. All the drink and the nuts and the Christmas tree and everything went out with a lot. Took the kids out, didn't we? Well, yes, we had a nice time. It was very primitive, though, at that time. It wasn't the sort of place that we could have lived on.
Roy Bates didn't allow a television out there. He thought this might be a distraction to the staff. I'm sure it would have been. So their only amusement, really, was more or less painting, decorating, and making the place more habitable. And the original officer's lounge, which had become our kind of mess room, we had Kayla gas cookers in there, a few armchairs, numerous electric fires, as it was very cold out there. And I wouldn't say it was at the point of luxury, but certainly quite comfortable. Next door to this lounge, we had the studio, which was only a very small, covered kind of affair. And then beyond that, the transmitting room. Well, the studio had a steel door. When this door was shut, it was virtually dead silent inside. You could hardly hear the generator. If someone left the door open, you could hardly hear yourself think. We had two turntables, Garrard 401s, I believe. We had one ribbon microphone, which sprouted out from the wall. We had a Vortexian tape recorder, which was left running day and night. This was used to play back the jingles and advertisements.
The aerial mast for Radio Essex was built from scaffolding poles which often blew down in strong winds. When the mast was operational, it was fed from a transmitter of ex-USAF origin.
Initially, there was one transmitter, an RCA Victor transmitter, with an output of about 1 kilowatt. This was originally intended for telephony. It was never intended as broadcast equipment. There were two engineers there who, over a period, built another transmitter of about a similar power with similar components, initially for use on Radio Kent, which never took place, but also it was also used as a standby for Radio Essex.
There's another port of Margate we were going to use for Kent. But as I say, we started to clear it up and get it ready, but the radio, the wireless telegraphy act, you know, became almost a certainty then, so it wasn't on. We had a full-time cooks, and then also some of them did took it in turns cooking, and they fancied they could cook a bit. They used to eat well and fairly good, strong, simple food, you know, nothing very complicated. I don't think we used any tin food at all in those days. It was all fresh food.
As far as food was concerned, it was, let's say, fairly average. We ate more than our fair share of corned beef, which was our staple diet, when everything ran short. Occasionally our cigarettes ran short as well, but I personally didn't smoke, so it didn't concern me too badly, but I know other members of the crew were very unhappy when the ciggies ran out. It wasn't uncommon to find a request in the middle of a packet of bread or something like that. This was quite common when the staff of the shop knew where the food was going.
The thing was, you see, my husband, as far as he's concerned, most of the DJs were wrapped up in the excitement of it, and my husband, being a very practical businessman, he was only interested in the business side of it, really. And if ever they wanted anything, I mean, they'd come to me first and talk me into talking Roy into whatever they wanted. Or things like when I sent the stores out, you know, they'd send in this, like, tea, coffee, cigarettes, girls drink, meat, bacon, you know, so on. Girls every third one, cigarettes and drink every fourth one. I just used to ignore those. cigarettes they got, the drink they only got at Christmas time because we always had a dry ship. The girls they didn't get.
But there were other things that did get onto the fort.
The most important thing, in fact, was diesel oil to keep the generators going. This was manhandled on board, exactly the same manner as the water was. We had a pulley and a large length of rope, and you can imagine the rest. We had to haul it up bodily. On the deck of the fort, there was an old aircraft fuel tank, which I suspect came from Channel Airways, one of our major advertisers. And this fuel tank would contain the diesel. And on top of the tank, there was a bunghole and a large funnel. And we would take the 5-gallon jar of diesel, stagger across the deck, pour the contents into the funnel, into the tank, and then take the can back and lower it back to go back on the tender. And this is how the tendering was done as far as diesel was concerned. Certainly a back-breaking job, and you stank of diesel for the rest of the week.
As well as food and fuel, the new records would come out on the tender.
Had kind of a diplomatic bag that would pass from the captain of the boat to the station manager. This contained fresh instructions with regard to advertising, any new tapes, and usually a large supply of records. The record companies were very, very generous to Radio Essex.
Yes, they used to shovel them at you. You didn't have to ask for them, they just shoveled them at you. And if they didn't shovel them at you, the people that had just made the records, they shoveled them at you. You know, you had them coming from every direction, their promotion people, their managers, the record companies. Oh, yes, you know, you could have built a house of the records they used to send you.
By now you are in tune with your spectrum of sound, Radio Essex, transmitting on 222 meters on the medium wave band, where the time right now is just 5 o'clock. And this is David Sinclair presenting this afternoon's edition of The Sound of Music. Music from a show, now in fact a British show, on the level. Here's Angela Richards to sing Strangely Attractive.
I always remember the first time that, so the first time it came over the air, and we had the Tijuana Brass, Spanish Flea.
We weren't wallpaper music, and we weren't pop. We were in the middle of the road. We were, you know, the big ballad and the big band, and at night we used to go on to really fairly heavy beat music for the younger people and the people that wanted to, you know, dance around, have a bit of cheer up. But during the day, we were really aiming for the housewife, because a local station, this is what you've got to go for.
The station ran from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. at first, later changing to a 24-hour format. Michael Caine remembers some of these show's presenters.
Very hospitable. I made friends very, very easily. As Dick Palmer and Mark West, or Mark Wesley as he's now known, were very great friends. And another chap, Roger Scott, who joined the same time as I did, I think was equally awe-inspired by going out to this structure in the sea. But we all used to get on very, very well indeed. In fact, we had to really, we lived virtually in each other's pockets.
Most of the fellows we had came to us for their first experience of being on the air. The fellows were coming in trying to build a career, and as a result they didn't want a great deal of money, so the salaries were about low to average, as I should say, on shore based salaries. DJs were popping up from under every rock, you know, every man had held a microphone in his hand at some time wanted to be a DJ. I mean, they were just tapes pouring in on you, you know, test tapes. And we had some damn good ones, actually. Some of those fellows were very, very good. And I'm glad to hear most of them are working all over the world now. So we had plenty to choose from. And some of them were very talented, very good. There was just Of course, a lot of people have sent in tapes and, or came to see you with no chance, but it was surprising how many talented, well, you know, you could have rigged up 100 stations with the talent that was there. It was there.
As well as the on-air staff, there were those equally important off-air ones, the engineers.
They sort of eat with the transmitter and live with the transmitter. You don't see them. About the end of 2 weeks, they come out and go ashore and you maybe get that one back or another one, but there was another one there sort of thing, and then he disappears and lives with the transmitter. They didn't live with women, they lived with transmitters.
One of the most important things for any commercial radio station is advertising.
Radio Essex was never designed to be anything else but a local station. We deliberately kept our signal power down so that it really did service Essex. Of course, we serviced Kent as well. But all our advertising was not national advertising, it was all county advertising. And we were the only one of the offshore stations that worked this way. And we did virtually what these commercial stations are doing now. We acted as local stations. We would prepare various ads which we could bend round to various forms of industry or jobs or shops. And then he'd go out, and if he thought he had a really hot prospect, as a big place to look at, that we thought we'd get a good contract from, we'd even make a tape up on spec for them. And he'd go out with his recorder, and if he'd get into the manager's or managing director's office, he'd play it. And they were always very impressed by it, because, you know, to hear it all with the music and the promo coming out, they just love it. But, of course, they weren't used to radio. They never used radio, and they used to say, oh, but, you know, we spend $20,000 a year on the papers, and they've always done as well, you know, and we can't change, and all this sort of thing used to get. So we used to sometimes say to we said to one rather large store once, who said that he spent $40,000 a year on newspapers, and we wanted some of this, you see. And he said, well, you know, you've got to prove to me that it'll work. So we took his telephone number and said, you won't be able to use your phone in your place here tomorrow. So all we did was put on the air, this man thinks nobody listens to us, Please telephone this number. And he was on the phone within 2 hours pleading with us to stop it, you know, because we blanked his phones out, you see. And it proved to him that it would work. So immediately he wanted 2 hours, please call it off and I'll sign. You had to prove it to them like this. In the beginning, we had to learn radio, we had to learn how to sell it. And people had to learn how to buy it too.
We had a chap called Harry Putnam that sold the advertising. Oh, yes, he had a sports car. I think it was his own. I'm certain it wasn't provided by the station. And he had the radio specially peaked to give optimum performance on 222 metres, the station's operating frequency, and that other wavelengths would, in fact, be depleted, so their signals would seem less strong. And so he could come up to a prospective advertiser and say, well, look, come and sit in my car and listen to the programmes of Radio Essex. And as he slid his tuner across the dial, other stations would sound quite weak compared with that of Radio Essex, which was probably the reverse way. Essex was, in fact, the weaker of most of the others.
My name is Roy Bates, and I would like to speak to you about Radio Essex. Two postmaster generals have made violent attacks on us, and to this time we have made no reply. However, we feel that the time has now come for us to speak our mind. I don't propose to bore you with long arguments, both judicial and technical, that have been put on both sides. No doubt if you have any interest in commercial radio, you will have heard or read about these. We on Radio Essex are British, and we believe that it is time that Britain had commercial radio. We also believe implicitly that it is as important to have a free radio as it is to have a free press. A free press is the watchdog of the people, and so also should be a free radio. We don't believe that we have taken an audience from any existing service. Rather, we have built an audience that didn't previously exist. On Radio Essex, we believe that in a free and democratic society, any member of that society should be able to listen to any program that they wish and not have this choice made for them by any government department or state monopoly. This is the essence of what the dispute really amounts to, free choice or regimentation. We on Radio Essex believe that the British people will not accept this regimentation and that they will insist on the freedom of choice, which is, after all, the birthright of every British subject. We hope you will give us your support in every way that you can. Petitions, letters to your MPs, to the press and the Postmaster General will all help to show that you really want to keep the services that we offer. We would like to thank you for your magnificent support in the past and hope that you will continue to give us your support in the future.
Roy Bates was served with a summons on the 28th of September 1966, alleging infringement of the Wireless Telegraphy Act. He stated he'd fight the case, the radio station's name would change, and a more powerful transmitter would be installed on the fault.
You're listening to the last 18 minutes of Formula 67 from BBMS 222, that's Britain's better music station, and unfortunately, owing to the fact that we have to do some engineering improvements, and we shall be doing this over the next few days as well. I'm afraid we have to close down at midnight tonight. Very, very sorry about that if you're enjoying the programme. If you're not, of course, it doesn't concern you because you're probably not listening to us. But if you are listening to us, you must obviously be enjoying the programme. Well, I've got another big back-to-front, something like that anyway. But what I'm trying to say is that we should be closing down at midnight tonight and reopening at 6 a.m. bright and early in the morning with Tony Mandel. How about that? Tony Mandel and the weekend special at BBMS 33, Avenue Road, Southend-on-Sea, in the county of Essex.
We did suffer a certain amount of boredom. You know, there was just sometimes nothing to do. And we did have a fight one day when an old bag of sprout suddenly found itself, and somebody threw one at somebody, and an all-out fight took place using other rotten vegetables. Well, that's how it started. And then somebody threw a bedstead down the corridor, and somebody then emptied a three-pound bag of flour over my head. And you try washing flour out of your hair in salty water.
But there were other problems for BBMS. The station had been fined £100 for broadcasting inside British territorial waters, and was decided to appeal. But before this could happen, the station closed. There's some doubt as to exactly when, but it would appear to be around Christmas 1966, although there are reports that the station closed after the appeal failed on the 17th of January 1967.
At the time, these stations were being heavily criticised by the government. And I think if you're told not to do something, the natural feeling is to try and do it. And I think this drove a lot of people to be more enthusiastic than they would have actually been.
Ray Collins, the orchestra, plus the chorus there from their album, Hi-Fi Companion, a number entitled I Could Have Danced All Night. Right now, I'd like to remind you that you're listening to Britain's better music station, broadcasting on a medium wavelength of 222 metres in the medium wave band. We're going to turn now on swing session program this afternoon to Duke Ellington and his famous orchestra, a number here which was recorded in April of 1953. It's called Prelude to a Kiss.
Of course, we were beaten into the ground for the last few months, really, because the appetites were getting very nervous of being with us. There were a lot of threats going on, you know, to them that sort of people that supply government offices or any form of government thing, they were afraid that they would get into trouble and lose their business or parts of their business. So there was a lot of pressure on. I was prepared to carry on broadcasting. And I said I would if I could get the revenue to come in. But of course the advertisers just would not. They wanted us to keep doing it. They used to ask us to please carry on and maybe they could do something, but you can't run a thing on maybes. You could cut the corners, but you couldn't cut them as fine as that. You know, they were just the Marine Offences Act washed us all up.
Most of the forts are still standing today, apart from the sunk head that was demolished in 1967. The army forts at Red Sands and Shivering Sands are streaked with rust. The catwalks are buckled or have fallen, mainly due to the Navy trying unsuccessfully to pull them down by firing chains over them. Anything that was possibly of any value has been removed from the forts. Ex-Radio City DJ Adrian Love visited them a few years ago.
The
like some mean so-and-so have been out there and stolen every available thing, apart from the kitchen sink and the gas stove. And the boatman that we went out with took great pleasure and pride in throwing this gas stove in and nearly threw it straight through the bottom of his own boat, which was rather amusing.
The only inhabitants nowadays of the army forts and of the navy forts at Knock John and Tung Sands are thousands of seagulls who've made it their home. Home nowadays for Roy Bates and his wife Joan is Ruff's Tower. They moved there in 1967 after Radio Essex closed, renamed the Fort Sealand and claimed it as their own state. Roy Bates explains.
Again, something that needs doing and it's never been done before. And naturally that attracted me. And
never be done again.
It will obviously never be done again.
Never be done again.
They've all learned how to stop it now, but they're a bit too late with me. It's happened, it's arrived. And it's the most challenging thing I've ever taken on in my life, and it's fascinating, very, very interesting. Very, you know, wherever you look, there's scope. And it was an idea we had. Well, we had it before radio, actually. Before we went into the radio, we were kicking this idea about. But the thing was, we didn't know whether we could do it or not because the territorial waters hadn't been defined in the British court. But of course, because of radio, they were. And so we knew where we could do it. So it was a two-edged sword for us, really, this Marine Defences Act. In one way it stopped something, and the other way it started something.
Since Sealand was formed, other people have realised its potential and several violent takeover bids have occurred. These have all failed.
Well, it's set up as a principality because there's no other way of doing it, really. Nothing else you can make it or call it. And that means I pass the laws. And eventually I will form a Senate, which I will hand over most of the authority to. We have consuls all over the world. We have officers. And yeah, we issue our own stamps, our own coinage, and issue our own passports. And we're going to build a large island, a free port, free trade area, rather like the Hong Kong of Europe.
When the island is fully developed, it will house a shipping marina, hotels, casinos, shops, houses, banks, factories, even a radio station.
It will be done as seen on radio, and not as a way of getting at somebody else in some other country.
Sealand is much more exciting. You've got so many different things in it. And, of course, radio is just one little thing.
Part of it.
It's all. Part of it, but it's only just one small thing.
A lot's happened to the sea fort since they were built in 1942. It seems a lot more is still yet to happen.